Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restoring the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. Well, so I'm going to give you the toll-free number, but I'm not, because we're not going to have time. I've got Bob Zadek in for our final show today, and we're going to get into the meat of his thoughts on Republic Review, so you really want to hear this. So if you can't listen to this show in its entirety today, this Saturday at 1 p.m. is the time to tune in for the rebroadcast, or you can always live stream wherever you are at these times, from 4 to 5 on Wednesdays and at 1 p.m. on Saturday. And if all else fails, you can always download the podcast at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. Again, there's reasons why you need to download, because these programs interact and provide further elucidations, clarifications, and so forth. And so all I ask is for you to understand and kind of stay abreast with what we need to be doing for Reclaiming the Republic and Republic Review. Then I just ask that you download all of the podcasts so you can actually hear all the academics and everybody else say, yeah, you know, everything you're talking about is constitutional. And then you can hear those who don't necessarily like or agree with, for whatever reason. And we can presume, if they don't tell us, we can make some deductions. But anyway, download the podcast at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org on the podcast page. For local announcements, the Republican Coffee Club at 7 in the morning, that's this coming Friday. Mike and Tim on the Right Spokane Perspective will be hosting, or actually they'll be the guests, and they'll be talking about this coming election, as well as I will today as well. On the 25th, on a side note, of November, the Center for Self-Governance is putting on a class. It's the level one class. It's $50. It's out in the valley if you want information on this. And I highly recommend this. This is very good information. If you want to learn about self-governance and how to become a self-governed, then you want to attend this. So anyway, that is on the 25th. And the Friday before that, on the 24th, that happens to be Black Friday, and the Republican Coffee Club, I guess, uses cream, so they won't be meeting on Black Friday. So anyway, the details of where the Republican Club is on my links page on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. Again, as I said, we're going to have Bob Zadek back on at the end of this segment, or at the beginning of next segment, actually. And so let me kind of leap forward into the election. But before I do, did you notice anyone in the state of Washington celebrating or even making note that Sunday, November 11th, it wasn't even Sunday, it wasn't Friday, it was the day in between those days, it was Saturday, November 11th, was Washington State's birthday. It was the 128th birth of the state. And so, if we are going to start getting centered on the Constitution, we have to start recognizing and understanding these constitutional things that help us understand republicanism and so forth. And there's nothing more important to a state than its being a stakeholder and participant in the Constitution. And therefore, acknowledging its birth is very important. Unless you're, you know, somebody that wants to subvert the Constitution and basically marginalize it so that they can get away with democracy and socialism and so forth. And I just think it's far more important that leaders start recognizing the birth of this state. And also, you know, most states actually celebrate their birthday, but this state, it's like you don't even hear it on the news. You don't hear any leaders talking about it. And I'm telling you, I tried to work with many of the leaders in this county, and not one lifted a finger, or not one took the time, maybe because of the election. I'm not giving anybody excuses, passes, or anything. I'll let them defend themselves. But I believe that there's probably one of the few dates out of the year that's very important in the Constitution for this state, and its birth is one of them. So I will stop my rant right before there. Anyway, by the numbers, there were only 30% of the potential voters that ballots were sent to actually voted. Out of the 30%, there were, and actually in the three state initiatives or ballot or measures that were on the ballot, out of that 30%, there was actually an overwhelming defeat of those measures by 20% of the voters. So in other words, 20% out of the 30, or I should say 20% greater than the rest. I think it was like 60 to 40, denied, repealed those taxes that the legislatures have put on us. So that means that the county had a, you know, a pretty heavy side towards the conservative view of these progressive taxes. So moving into the Spokane proper, Spokane City, 15% of the voters in Spokane City actually voted against the unconstitutional, you know, Proposition 2 or that coal oil train initiative that the progressive city council tried to ram down their throats. And so that means that 15% of the city of Spokane sided on the conservative side of that issue. Now, so here's what really kind of kills me. Out of the three progressive candidates, every single one of them won by 15%. And so what happened? Does this have something to do with the progressive, name calling, or I should say late type of news like what Candace Mum did and so forth? Or was there just a disconnect between the voters on the issues and the voters on the candidates? I don't know. But when you start looking at the Valley, this is even a big head scratcher because these ballots were basically, or I should say the candidates, the majority of all the candidates lost overwhelmingly by what I would consider the progressive candidates. And so, and what I say by progressive candidates, those that were backed by SEIU and labor and so forth, and they actually won by 15% out in the Valley. So I'm just having a hard time understanding what happened to that little conservative bastion that's out there in the Valley compared to what's happening in the rest of the county. And it seems like it kind of aligned that 15% with the city voting for the progressive candidates as well. Now, there was one race with Rod Higgins that he barely won by 2% that didn't, it was far enough away that it didn't require a recount, but still that was very close. And so I've got to look at the ephemeral data as to why, you know, this was done. But I did witness that there's, after this election, there has been a lot of finger pointing and, a lot of leaders that are, kind of going in different directions and so forth. And it just seems like there's a big leadership problem and that there's this big division amongst these leaders, or if you want to call them leaders, but I think what we're really dealing with are managers who are managing petty agendas. But again, I've got to get to the ephemeral information, some of this data that might get lost over the next year or two because it's kind of temporary, such as who backed who and why did they back each other. And I want to have a really good picture so that I can kind of start looking at leadership and endorsements and going, okay, so here are the leaders that I believe had an influence, or I should say managers who had an influence, because the difference between a leader and a manager when it comes to politics is a leader does the right for all. They just do what's right for all. A manager manages their petty agendas and their issues, and they don't put the Constitution center. A good candidate and a good political leader centers themselves on the Constitution. And so that's why, I think it's really important to kind of garner this so that we can start moving forward. Because as we jump forward into the next campaign, I think maybe that's when we can start shaking or separating the wheat from the chaff. Because bottom line, it's either leadership starts changing their ways and starts centering themselves on the Constitution, or these leaders need to be changed so that we actually have leaders that do that. Because I believe it is critical that the constituents, the citizens within this republic, within this county, are represented by people who take their oath and uphold their oath very seriously. And so I will get you that more information as it comes forward. But I will also let you know that next week we're going to be having a special program on Thanksgiving, and I know you're really going to enjoy it, so please stay tuned for Bob Zadek and next week the special message that I have, historical message on Thanksgiving. Stay tuned. We'll be right back, folks. Okay, we're back, and as promised, I've been able to get Bob back to discuss a little further the Republic Review, because he piqued my interest as we were closing out our last conversation, as he was being swept away to his nuptial commitments. And so, Bob, you said that you were my number one fan.
I am a great fan of what you are doing. I support the effort, because I strongly support, as you know, principles of federalism.
Yes.
And I consider all of the interesting activity in government to be at the state and local level and not at the federal level. If we look at what's happening today, at the federal level, there is, in almost every agency, inaction, incompetence, or gridlock. And nothing is being done.
At now, a great expense. I'm just throwing in, this is all being done at a great expense, right?
At great expense. While at the state level, and I'll quickly add, for better or for worse, but nevertheless, at the state level, stuff is actually being done. And states are doing something. And that's very important, because as states adopt a different approach, i.e. compare governmental activity in California with, for example, governmental activity in Texas, it's night and day. It's not the same country. But people can vote whether they want to live in Texas or in California. And voting with one's feet is a far more, it's a louder vote, it's a more dramatic vote, and it's more significant than voting at the ballot box.
Sure.
So it gives people a chance to put their money where their mouth is and to make a tangible decision about from the states what allows us to do that. The fact that I can move to Canada is not a great consolation. The fact that I can move to Nevada is a big deal.
Sure, absolutely. And so one of the things that I believe you might be able to appreciate this is the type of resistance that I actually have in trying to initiate this movement. And so I'm not sure. So most people would go, yeah, I can understand the progressives, but I believe you can probably fathom that the conservative political system and conservative political institutions that are out there, I don't think that they're really, if they come on board with this, it's going to be because they are kicking and screaming and dragging their feet on coming on board, because they like their life the way it is. And as a matter of fact, my introduction to most people is, you know, that are working in the trenches like yourself, or actually other people that are like Trevor Lawton is one who did the movie Enemies Within. I'm not sure if you know who he is, but my first thing I ask them is, are you ready to retire what you're doing?
That's a challenging question and a hard question for most people.
Well, absolutely. But I truly believe that Republic Review, if invoked and starts moving down that direction, one, people, it'll force the education of not only leadership, but the electorate, it will shift paradigms, and it will get us moving back in the direction that the framers put us in, true self-governance and truly understanding that monopolizing power in government is never a good thing.
Well, part of the resistance to your movement is it's a devolution in power. It's moving the power down a bunch of notches from the small ruling elite to the larger population as a group. And the people who are resistant are the people who lose power. And the individuals who are accepting the power, for a lot of them, they have been bought off. There are so many constituencies who see government as nothing other than a dispenser of goodies, which is not at all the function why governments were created.
Correct.
But if you are a recipient of the goodies, you say, this works for me. I'm getting lots of goodies. I kind of like it the way it is. So the trouble is, governments have become very clever on building constituencies by buying them off and giving them goodies so they support the status quo.
Right. And you know, back to your point, by moving these this power base back notches, it lines up with what Madison and Hamilton and others said, both in the ratification and especially in the Federalist Papers, where they kept on pointing to and alluding to the fact that the states had the better position because they had their people's interest at heart. They had to.
They were
to.
Closer. Well, Absolutely. It's not that they had the better. They were closer to the people.
Right.
To the extent that government is closer to the people, it knows more what the people expect of government. When government is far away, that relationship withers and dies. And that's what Madison meant. In fact, it's not just states. States are closer than Washington. Cities are closer than states. Counties may be closer than cities.
Right.
And frankly, I'd rather be governed by the people who live on my dock than by Washington.
And in some ways, they probably do govern you.
They do, but not in ways that they're aware of.
But not tyrannical, right? I mean, it's not like they're saying, well, you're going to have to heave ho and more over there or those types of things. It's and it's not arbitrary. Yeah, I mean, they basically put it – because as I try to spell this out to folks, this is a contract. This Constitution is a contract. And it's just like everything else. And I deal with people that talk about contract law and so forth. And I go, most contracts don't actually exude laws themselves. I mean, my contract with Verizon, there's no such thing as Verizon law. And so it's amazing how we've allowed, and I don't know if it's just the inherent nature of politics and law, but it just seems like so many people, either they get a headache when they deal with politics and law that they kind of just leave it to that. But, I mean, help me out here. Am I wrong to think that we've kind of been maybe taken advantage of? I wouldn't even say that. I think we've been lied to by a lot of politicians and lawyers saying, well, this is complicated, and, you know, you need us to interpret this. And as hard as it was for Madison, I truly believe that his intent was to try to create a contract with the people in the states to ensure that they could understand what their government was and how limited they were.
The trouble is, you're exactly right, but you venture into somewhat of a briar patch when you say things like what Madison intended, because Madison, as most of the founders, their views on the relationship between citizens and government changed over time.
Sure.
And sometimes they changed more than once. So if you say Madison thought something, I'd have to quickly ask you, what month and year are we talking about?
Right.
Because either you're right or you're wrong. It's very hard to parse out what the founders intended. And most originalists, people who interpret the Constitution by trying to determine its original meaning, don't focus on what the founders intended, but rather what the voters who ratified the Constitution, what they understood it to mean.
There you go.
It's what was in the mind of the signer
right.
that matters. When you mentioned a contract. When you sign a contract, and if the meanings of the words changed over time, the meaning 10 years from now don't matter. It's what those words meant when you signed it.
Correct.
Because that's what you intended. It's what was in your mind when you were a contracting party. Similarly, when voters ratify the Constitution, the issue is, what was the Constitution in their mind when they ratified? Not what those words have become today.
Right. And that actually goes into line with why I have emphasized the ratification debates so heavily in both my writings and the work. If you could hold on for another segment, Bob, I'd like to bring you back and we can talk about the ratification and what they mean in the contract. So folks, if you could please stay tuned, and we'll just take a quick break with our sponsors. So we'll be right back after this. Thanks a lot. Okay, so we're back again with Bob, and we were just going into break when I was talking about the importance of the ratification debates, because this is where the framers were literally spelling out what line, what each line meant, what each clause and what these words were intending. And in most contracts, if you've gone through a divorce and you've mediated, or you've gone through any type of mediation or arbitration or what have you, those notes or those documents that are created from that arbitration are appended to and or directly attached to the contract, such as a divorce or what have you. And so I'm amazed at the fact that they marginalized these ratification debates for so long, even though they were, as far as I'm concerned, appendages to the contract.
What's interesting about studying the ratification debates, as I have studied them, I have come to conclude that it is quite significant, albeit little known, that the first really dirty election in American history was the election that dealt with ratification. Sure. So our country is founded on the principle of really dirty debates and elections.
Yeah.
The ratification process was ugly. And I dare say, if I were around then, I would have voted against ratification. And I dare say I would have been right. When I read about ratification, even today, I hope the vote goes the other way and it doesn't get ratified, believe it or not. But it went the way it did. So if one reads the history of the ratification, it's a very nasty debate when the voters are denied lots of important information.
Oh, sure.
It's a whole subject in itself, and I invite our listeners to learn about ratification, the best kept secret in American history.
Right. Well, you know, it was a different paradigm back then, because not everybody voted. There were most of the states, as I understand it, it was the property owner, even if he had two or three sons that were of legal age still living at home, they couldn't vote. It was only the property owner that was able to go, and they had to prove their ownership of property. And if the sheriff didn't believe them, come to find out, then the sheriff could deny them from voting. And so the paradigm back then was a lot different in understanding suffrage. And so in some ways, I think, you know, we've digressed in maybe a bad way, because we've just thrown voting out to anybody and everybody who doesn't even have skin in the game. And so that's just that paradigm. And in the context of delegating their representation to these people who are going to participate in the ratification debates, if you look at who was in those ratification debates, those were the who's who of politics.
Exactly right. One minor comment. Everything you said was spot on. One minor comment is that voting was limited in most colonies, now states, to landowners. Now, that seems kind of restrictive. What about all the tenants? But in colonial America, almost everybody owned land.
Yes.
A huge percentage of the population was, in fact, a landowner. and had property. So it wasn't just property, it was real property, not personal property. But it didn't exclude as high a percentage of the population as that same rule would have excluded today. Just as a, and having land didn't necessarily mean that you were wealthy. It just meant that you had land. Land was free then. Remember, it was given away.
Sure.
So having land was no big deal then.
Sure. And actually, the reason that we're in this situation today is because a new ideology came in shortly after the founding of this nation where land was, private property was to be abolished. And that's communism.
Well, there's a whole, that subject of whether private property is theft is a whole scholarship discussion. And there are lots of otherwise sensible people who take the position that the whole concept of private property is itself a destructive of the public good. That's a whole other conversation, but I invite the listeners to read a recent comment by Mayor of New York de Blasio, who bemoaned the fact that private property interferes with good government.
Right.
And he said that only a month ago.
And, you know, one of the best articles that I've read, if you want to understand truly what property means, and it doesn't mean the tangible physical land, read Madison's 1792 article on property. He wrote an essay defining what property was. Property wasn't just something physical, and it wasn't just your thoughts, but it was the right to those things. And so that's one of the reasons why they argued, and the Mayberry v. Mayberry v. Madison, they created property to your job in the federal government, and so which was an interesting concept, which we don't even fathom that today because most people don't consider their employment property. Go ahead.
Definition. Property meant rights as well as tangible goods.
Sure.
So when you are entitled to your life, liberty, and property, it didn't just mean stuff. It
right.
meant your right to be left alone, freedom of speech, and the like.
Correct. And we've lost that. But anyway, the thing I love about the debates, and you've in studying those, I'm sure you get this, the conflict in personalities, both in the New York debates with Governor Clinton and Hamilton, and the same thing with Henry and the Federalists and some of the other anti-Federalists, the way they slung things. The other paradigm most people don't know is it was still legal in almost all of these states that if you impugned or you basically challenged the integrity of another man, that was, you know, reasonable rights for that person to challenge you to a duel.
Well, dueling, I'd like to come back on your show and spend the whole hour discussing one of my favorite political/social topics, which is, I strongly believe, I'm not saying this to gather attention, I strongly believe that dueling under reasonable rules ought to be legal. I love the concept of dueling, and the byproducts of dueling, if it's done between politicians, is at the end of the day, we have one less politician. But I mean that only facetiously. But dueling is a very interesting sociological debate on what's wrong with dueling. And the answer is not much.
Not much.
We allow prize fighting,
right,
which is as close as we get to it, when one person could be killed by another and that would not be a crime. So we like prize fighting when one person beats the heck out of somebody else, but we don't like dueling. But that's for another show.
Yes. So I will add this to this as well, because there's a lot of old adages that I can think tie into this, but I think the best one is that back in those days, honor meant more to man than life itself, and men were willing to die for their honor and their integrity, and not only for themselves, but for their whatever their causes were, whether that cause was liberty or even their wife, their family, or over something as minor as, you know, just their property and those types of things. there were many people that would be willing to stand up, and nine times out of ten, it was those who were the antagonists that would either have to go away, and they became labeled as antagonists. But the best historical duel, I think, that we most know of would be Burr and Hamilton. And as unfortunate as the way those things panned out, I just think that Hamilton didn't know who he was messing with when he decided to tangle with Burr.
The way to commit suicide. Hamilton shot first, by all accounts, shot high, intentionally missed Burr. And in most duels, it was expected that the antagonist would not shoot to kill. That was kind of the understanding. And it would be highly unusual to do what Burr did, which is shoot to kill. That duel has been the subject of many writings, many whole books devoted to the duel.
Right.
It is a fascinating insight into life in our country at that time.
Right. Right. Well, I know we're about done with this segment, but I would like to actually hold you on, and maybe we can close out in this next segment about maybe some insights that you might be able to give me in helping this move forward. So,
actually, I plan on being on for the next about hour and a half. So just tell your engineer, would you?
Okay. Yeah. So there's obviously a big difference between this time and the last time. Something, some big event, I guess, was happening. So anyway, folks, we're coming up on this hard break. So if you would please stay tuned, and we will be right back after we have another segment of sponsorship. Please hang on. We'll be right back. Okay, so we're back, and this is our third segment with Bob Zadek. And did I get that right, Zadek?
It's good enough. It's not exactly right.
Okay, Zadek.
My parents pronounced it differently, but anyway, works for you. It's fine with me.
Okay, and actually, before we close out the segment, what I wanted to do was make sure that I captured where your book is available. And you've got just the one book, The Secret Sauce, maybe The Anti-Federalists Were Right, something like that.
Well, you say just the one book. I have a life, you know. I can't just spend my life writing books. But the answer is yes.
If you could let me know where people could get that book. Is it on Amazon or?
On Amazon. And it goes for the exorbitant price of 99 cents, but you get the 99 cents back. So the book is essentially free. It's The Secret Sauce of Liberty, Were the Anti-Federalists Right? It is excerpts from some pretty wonderful interviews that I was lucky enough to conduct over my 10 years on radio. So it is the words of many of my interviewees, which are knit together in a very coherent story where you end up hoping against hope that the Constitution doesn't get ratified, even though you kind of know the ending.
Yeah. I actually, when I read it, I didn't go through that turmoil and emotions, but I found it fascinating. And I did find some of the information and points that your callers were making were very interesting. But I only had some exceptions just because my paradigm is a little bit different, because a lot of the, I think some of your guests actually look or accepted the federal government in a certain way and so forth. And I'm at that point where I just don't. I don't accept it anymore. And so I've kind of drawn that line. I'm moving on. And so I guess my question for you is, how can I better engage, you know, the party systems, and how can, because one of the things I'm trying to do is here in the Spokane area is engaging and bringing together the Libertarian Constitution and Republican parties to put aside their differences and start working and basically supporting, because we have a two candidate runoff general election. In other words, we have a primary that boils it down to the top two. And so there's no way going into the general election will you ever have, you could if it was a Constitution Party and a Libertarian Party candidate or something like that. But I would like to see them finally get to a point where these parties could just say, you know, we need to all start backing the most constitutional candidate that's going to stand up to these, you know, strings attached federal tyranny grants and these other things that they're piping into both city, county, and state government, and move this forward, as well as getting them to petition the state legislatures for convening this convention that would be not a convention to amend the Constitution, but to audit it and put the federal government back into the scope of the existing contract. So any insights or ideas?
Funny you should ask. I have a few. First of all, I tend to ignore party labels because the parties are nothing other than, in my phrase, marketing cooperatives. It is a group of pressure groups that get together to, so they can hopefully accumulate 51% of the population. There's no coherent philosophical point of view. There's only the collection of a lot of pressure groups. For example, if you wanted to find a book that says, let me read about Republican philosophy, and let me find a Republican philosopher. Doesn't exist on earth. When I was in summer camp, we had color wars, the red team and the blue team. The camp was divided up arbitrarily into two teams, red and blue, and you competed in athletics. Color war is equivalent to our political parties. There are random people who have no governing political philosophy. They just became Democrats or Republicans for the sole purpose of getting elected. Therefore, select candidates on the basis of issues. Right. And the issues stands for the governing principle of devolving power from the government to the people. Which candidates stand for the most freedom? And if that becomes the litmus test, it would be interesting how often you might end up voting for, if you are a rock-ribbed Republican, you might end up selecting a Democrat. And there are certain issues that transcend party lines. And Rand Paul and Cory Booker found one of them, just by way of example, right, which is criminal justice sentencing reform. There's no Democratic or political or Republican position. There's only the right or the wrong position. And that's a classic issue of removing government from our lives. And if you vote that way, over time, government will be more to our liking.
Right, right. Another thing that I'm also trying to do is I'm trying to get the local candidates to start petitioning the states. And I'm working with a lot of people to help me in introduce this concept to what I would consider my four primary targets, if I can use that word. And those would be Wyoming, South Dakota, Utah, and Idaho. Those are the four states that have the highest percentage of, and I'm using air quotes here, conservative Republicans to, you know, liberal Democrats. And these are really the four foremost conservative states. And so I'm hoping that I can get the state legislatures of one of those states to, you know, start moving this audit concept, because they all clamor on, you know, federal tyranny and the arbitrary power and all these things that are coming down. As a matter of fact, in 2016, Utah just did another resolution that they want to repeal the 17th Amendment. And I'm going, well, these would be good. So what I'm trying to do is find somebody that can help introduce me to that and or get this concept inducted into their floor and discussions, and I believe moving this forward. Because if I can get one state, just one state, to say we're auditing this Constitution, then I truly believe that the majority of my work is done, and now it's just a matter of letting this sales team, this state, and these legislatures move this forward.
I hope I never get to the point in my life when I will ever say the majority of my work is done. I like being really behind. It gives me a reason to jump out of bed in the morning, so hopefully I can catch up with my work. So if your goal is you want the majority of your work to be done, you and I on that one issue, part company.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying.
Right. So I don't like politics. I don't want to be a part of this other than as a citizen. And I want to move back into doing my own venture capital or doing my own entrepreneurial thing in making money and developing wealth, because there should be no process of developing wealth in politics. And I think that was one of the big secrets that the framers had, because they set aside their individual interests and their differences between each other to work together. And so anyway, I do have interests.
That's good. So you have a reason, as I do, to leap out of bed in this morning.
Yes.
And get started to get caught up.
Right.
So we agree.
So is there anyone or any way that you could think of other than maybe, you know, faking putting myself on fire, you know, outside the capital of one of these states to get this attention? Any ideas?
You obviously have to do it incrementally. And what's interesting is 10 years ago, I would have thought the concept of federalism, of power at the state level as opposed to the federal level, is gone. But then over the past 10 years, what have we seen? We have seen states decriminalize marijuana in clear violation of federal law. We have seen states say, we are going to establish sanctuary cities and in California, sanctuary states. In other words, Washington, drop dead. We're doing what we want. We have seen in many, many ways, we have seen local police forces refusing to enforce federal drug laws. So more, and we have seen states refuse to accept Medicaid funding, saying we want to run our state healthcare system the way we want. So interestingly enough, when I thought it was over, no more federalism, states are enjoying a resurgence in the past, let's say, 10 years that I don't remember happening in any other 10-year period in history. So, and it's incremental.
Right.
But states are realizing if they put their thumb in the eye of Washington, nothing bad happens. And once you discover nothing bad happens, you then are empowered.
Right.
So when you achieve minor successes and nothing bad happens to you, and indeed good things happen, you are empowered, and the people you're trying to motivate are empowered. And they say, hey, you know, the guy's got something, and off you go.
And there we go. What a great segue to end it on. Thank you again for your time, Bob, and we'll have you back on some other time.
How about in about 20 minutes?
Well, we'll talk about that.
Have a nice day.
Have a nice day, too. Bye, Bob.